official reluctance to consider the sanitary and environmental impact of depleted uranium can also be explained by economic reasons.
Obviously, from the Army's point of view, and technically, if I have to make a hole in a tank, depleted uranium is great, because it's really effective, and it's recyclable too. I think in that situation there's little to be said.
It's a win-win situation.
Yes, but just one detail. In Serbia, they saw that to clean one 30-millimeter head from shells that were fired, just to clean where they landed, they spent $300,000, more or less. It might be a win-win situation, but if I have to clean up afterwards...
It's a very expensive win-win situation.
Exactly, for the authorities. And those are figures that have been acknowledged and quoted.
The cost of cleaning up a zone contaminated by depleted uranium dust makes it hard to envisage that the battlefields will one day be rehabilitated. And there's worse. The depleted uranium producing countries like the US and France have to deal with the accumulation of increasingly vast stocks. More than 700,000 tons in the US, almost 200,000 tons in France. Robert Alvarez, a former advisor to the US Energy Department, has been sounding the alarm bells for a number of years.
What we are dealing with, in a certain respect, is what I call national sacrifice zones, that we, in order to amass nuclear weapons in this country, we created very large, profound areas of contamination where we simply lack the capability and the technology to restore them to their original conditions, much less to conditions that would allow even limited uses. So these are areas that we more or less have to sacrifice in the name of nuclear deterrence.
It is by chance that I make an astonishing discovery in Iraq, which confirms Robert Alvarez's alarmist prediction. Close to Basra Airport, the broken shells of tanks destroyed in 2003 are lined up along the road. Soldiers tell me of incidents previously kept secret.
The tanks were contaminated by uranium. A team from the Environment Ministry examined them, and they confirmed the contamination. From time to time, the Americans and the British come here, and they take tanks away somewhere, transporting them further away from the airport. But we don't know what becomes of them.
But I want to know. For the contaminated scrap metal, this mysterious destination is the end of the road, and finding it would mean the end of my investigation. I decide to speak to General Jabbar, who commands the border police in the Basra region.
Some of the scrap was moved to this desert place. How do you call it?
It's called Afr el Batin.
When was it moved there?
The program was set up in 2008. To this provisional site, they've transported 150 tons of scrap metal.
What happened to the scrap? When it gets there, when they bring it there, then they put it in the ground, what do they do with the scrap?
They dig and they put it in holes in the ground. They simply take it from one place to another. Obviously, it's in the desert. But according to our information, there are water tables below. Scientific reports say it's potentially dangerous for the water.
I do my utmost to get to Afr el Batin. I need an authorization and an escort. General Jabbar promises to help. But then a counter order arrives from Baghdad. The affair is beyond his authority, and only a minister can give me the required permission. I know Iraq too well. It will never happen.
One of the things you learn as a child is clean up your own mess. Don't expect somebody else to come in here and pick up your crayons and your toys. So we did this war of choice, and my view is that we have a responsibility for the mess we leave. We can't walk away and just say, well, we don't care.
The depleted uranium question, like any question involving armies, weapons, and wars, suffers from a lack of transparency, from a lack of precise democratic control on both national and European levels. I think the priority is to continue the fight on the UN level, which is very useful, and also within the European Union, so that we can obtain a moratorium on depleted uranium munitions.
Countries that have used depleted uranium weapons, quite obviously, are not interested in being raked over the coals for a weapon system they feel they have a right to use and which they feel is not dangerous. But we will see. The international community doesn't stand still on these kinds of things. And I think that if there's an increasing effort to say, look, here are the damages, and you have to have something concrete, and you have to say that this is more than a supposition, and that we have done some research, and unfortunately, you have to bring examples of where beyond the pure use of depleted uranium as a tank buster, you have created a special kind of damage to the individuals beyond what normally conventional weapons create. Then I think you have a basis for moving ahead.
Depleted uranium munitions were invented in the 1970s to combat Moscow's armored divisions. The Soviet enemy has disappeared, but this all-powerful arsenal has remained. Those responsible for authorizing its use will one day have to be accountable to the victims and explain why they turned a deaf ear to every appeal for caution.
The most brave people are the people who've never been to war. The ones who think war is such a great deal and want to go to the parades and stand there and see the flags go by near the bands. They haven't been anywhere near what it's like when they come.
That's it for this week's episode. Until next week and another Aperture. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech delivered on September 21st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with participants in ceremonies throughout the country to honor the veterans of the Sacred Defense Era. The meeting was held on the occasion of 40th anniversary of the sacred defense.
They gave Saddam Mirage to bombard us, super ethundered, for striking our ships, as well as giving him satellite information on the movement of our forces and the places where they stated. Their assistance to the Iraqis ranged from money to tanks, chemical weapons, and all sorts of other things. They even gave him chemical weapons, and Saddam used them against us. He also used them against his own nation. In Halabja, he used chemical weapons, and in our country too. He used them many times. In other words, the West and Europe violated and trampled upon all their philanthropic and human rights claims in their interaction with the Iraqis. They invalidated all their claims by defending the corrupt, dictatorial, and anti-human regime of Saddam. Having a deep understanding about these matters is very precious to us. We should really know who Westerners are, and we should decide, think, and work accordingly.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The last point that I want to raise is that a great incident occurred in the sacred defense era. The fact that it revealed the capabilities and capacities of the Iranian nation to the whole world. In other words, it turned into a medium. All media in the world were against us. Global media were against the revolution. Of course, the same situation exists today. It was also the case at that time. In the beginning of the revolution, official media in the world either lied, denied our strong points, or slandered everyone, including Imam, the government of the Islamic Republic, the masses of the people, the judiciary branch, the armed forces, and everyone else. They worked continuously against them, and they wanted to portray the Iranian nation as bad people in the eyes of people all over the world.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The limelight.
Over the past 11 months, about 20,000 people have braved the Atlantic route from Africa to Europe, with more than 8,000 arriving in the Canaries in November alone. Last year, 2,557 migrants arrived in the archipelago, up from 1,307 in 2018. Nowhere is the strain and chaos more evident than on the dock at Arginaguen. At a makeshift receptor center cobbled together 4 months ago and intended to shelter 500 people, the number of occupants has swelled to almost 2,700 over recent weeks. According to official figures, Arginaguen has a population of 2,309. The people held at the temporary center, officially for a maximum of 72 hours, are living in cramped conditions, some in tents, but many sleeping on the sun-baked, rat-infested bare dock. We now present you an article written by Eduardo Robena and Sam Jones. The piece is titled, "This Lack of Humanity Can't Go On. Canary Islands Struggle with Huge Rise in Migration." The article has been taken from the website of the British newspaper The Guardian. Stay with us for more of Eduardo Robena and Sam Jones's article. In the Canary Islands, 2020 will be remembered as more than just the year of the coronavirus. The streets of Arginaguen, a small town on the island of Gran Canaria, has thronged not with tourists in search of winter warmth, but with police officers, health workers, and journalists, all scurrying to and from the crowded dock, which has become the newest symbol of an old phenomena. Almost 15 years after the Cayuco crisis of 2006, when about 36,000 people reached the Spanish archipelago in small and dangerous cayucos or fishing boats, the Canaries are once again struggling to cope with the arrival of thousands of migrants and refugees. Over the past 11 months, about 20,000 people have braved the Atlantic route from Africa to Europe, with more than 8,000 arriving in the Canaries in November alone. Last year, 2,557 migrants arrived in the archipelago, up from 1,307 in 2018. Nowhere is the strain and chaos more evident than on the dock at Arginaguen. At the makeshift reception center cobbled together 4 months ago and intended to shelter just 500 people, the number of occupants has swelled to almost 2,700 over recent weeks. According to official figures, Arginaguen has a population of just 2,309. The people held at the temporary center officially for a maximum of 72 hours, arriving in cramped conditions, some in tents, but many sleeping on the sun-baked, rat-infested bare dock. Most of their fellow arrivals have progressed to purported better-equipped temporary camps further inland, government reception centers, or hotel rooms. There has been a rise in the use of the Atlantic route this year, amid enduring conflicts, land border closures forced by the pandemic, and increased controls in some North African countries. Smuggling gangs have reactivated the long and perilous crossing, ferrying thousands of men, women, and children between the two continents. Those lucky enough to land on the Canaries find themselves pitched into a confused, disjointed, and under-resourced system. Spain's public ombudsman has called for the Arginaguen camp to be shut down at once on the grounds that it could be violating people's basic rights. Recently, a judge claimed that while the conditions at the camp were deplorable, they did not constitute a crime. The complaint had been brought by the Onalia Bueno, the mayor of the municipality of Mogán, of which Arginaguen is a part. Citing the events of 17th of November in particular, Mayor Onalia Bueno despairs at the lack of coordination between central government ministries, that day as the dock center was completely overwhelmed. 200 Moroccans were removed by police officers, put on buses bound for the island's capital, Las Palmas, and left without anywhere to stay. While the migration ministry finally stepped in and found accommodation for them, Mayor Onalio Bueno says the event was symptomatic of a deep and troubling absence of political will. She says this lack of humanity from the government just can't go on, adding, "It doesn't seem to be able to solve the problem at hand." And yet, she adds, Spain found its way through the Cayuco crisis in 2006. José Segura Clavel, who was the central government's representative in the Canaries at the time, says the two situations do not bear comparison. Segura Clavel points out that the pandemic means repatriation flights are impossible, but says the migrants and refugees are not getting the humanitarian reception to which they're entitled. However, José Segura Clavel adds if Spanish authorities are failing to live up to their obligations, then so is the European Union. It says the EU's behavior is a mistake, adding, "We don't have a clear common policy." The lack of a clear, common, and fair approach to migration was spelt out in the letter that Spain, Italy, Greece, and Malta sent to the European Commission recently in response to the European Union's new migration and asylum proposals. The four countries said, "We believe that the solidarity rules and the related commitments of all member states must be clearly defined," adding, "The frontline member states cannot face the migratory pressure on the whole of the European Union. We must find feasible and coordinated solutions to our common challenges." In the meantime, the pressure at the Arguineguín dock is belatedly easing. Each day, people are being transferred to a former military camp on the island, which can house up to 1,000 people. But there are fears the winter rains could turn the camp into a mud bath. About 6,000 people, including more than 455 unaccompanied children, are being put up in hotel rooms paid for by the Spanish government. More than 3,470 of them are staying in 10 hotels in Mogán. But things are far from settled, and tempers far from cool. Recently, Mayor Bueno issued an ultimatum to the Migration Ministry warning that Mogán Solidarity has a best-before date of 31st of December, and asking the central government to remove the migrants and refugees from hotels and accommodate them elsewhere. Secretary of State for Migrations, Hannah Jalul, said the Interior Ministry was working to repatriate all those not eligible for asylum, but added that the new arrivals needed to be properly looked after. Jalul said recently, "If I left those migrants on the streets right now, social services would have to take responsibility for them," adding, "Do you think that the mayor has the resources to house 3,400 migrants?" Silvanos Camara, a 22-year-old migrant from Sierra Leone, is one of those staying in a hotel. Although the Interior Ministry, which is trying to shut down the dock camp as soon as possible, says no one stays on the docks for more than 72 hours, Silvanos Camara spent 8 days at the camp. On a recent visit, Human Rights Watch spoke to people who had been held there for more than 2 weeks. Like many of his fellow migrants, Camara clambered into a crowded boat in the Senegalese port of Mbour one day in October in search of a future. Faced with a lack of work and prospects at home, he decided to gamble on the dangerous sea crossing, leaving his 5-year-old daughter in the care of his sister. But unlike most of the new arrivals in the Canaries, Silvanos Camara has no plans to move to the mainland. One of the few items he brought with him is the strip of the local football team, UD Las Palmas, whose matches he used to watch back home. Camara says the Canaries, a great place, remind him of Africa. His dream now is to pick up the nascent football career he left behind in Sierra Leone. He rises at about 6 a.m. local time every day to train on the beach 2 miles away and hopes his dedication will pay off. Kamara says, "I was doing my exercises when a trainer from the local team came over and offered me the chance to train with them. Anything more permanent will depend on the young Sierra Leonean sorting out his papers, something that already overstretched Red Cross is trying to help him with." The frustration and anger expressed by local people and politicians is echoed by some of the non-governmental organizations sharing the strain. For Texema Santana of the Spanish Commission for Refugee Aid, the conversion of the military camp just goes to show that there could have been an alternative to the dock center a long time ago. Like many others, not least the regional president of the Canaries, Texema Santana sees clear parallels between what is happening on the archipelago and what has already happened in Lampedusa in Italy and Lesbos in Greece. The numbers may differ, but the response does not. Texema Santana says the European Union views island territories as prisons. But for those less fortunate, the Canaries and the waters that lead to them are not prisons, but cemeteries. In October, at least 140 people died when the boat carrying them from Senegal caught fire and capsized in the deadliest shipwreck recorded so far this year. Recently, 8 people died when their boat ran into rocks as they attempted to land on Lanzarote in Canaries. According to the International Organization for Migration, IOM, at least 563 people have died in the Atlantic Ocean in 2020, trying to cross from Africa into the Canaries. The figure does not take into account the Lanzarote deaths, nor the 10 other possible but unconfirmed shipwrecks that the International Organization Migration IOM is looking into. Texema Santana says, "Until we have a safe, legal and organized way for people to move about, we're going to carry on seeing these irregular crossings." He added, "There will always be people ready to traffic other people and to sell them the dream of reaching another land."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, a wave of anti-Islamic sentiment seems to have hit France, being led by the government itself. French President Emmanuel Macron earlier this year said that Islam is in crisis and immediately started the process of implementing policies to control Muslims in that country. The latest move by the French government is shutting down an anti-Islamophobia group. Is Paris at war with Islam, or, as Macron has said, is it simply trying to control extremists?
France is stepping up its crackdown against Muslims across the country. Earlier this week, the Interior Minister announced the dissolution of an anti-Islamophobia group called Collective Against Islamophobia in France. The group is known as CCIF. The government has accused it of being engaged in activities that provoke hate and acts of terrorism. Prominent rights group Human Rights Watch has condemned the move as a threat to basic human rights. It said the measure risks further stigmatizing Muslims in France.
Whatever its intention, this measure risks further stigmatizing Muslims in France. Shutting down an organization that raises legitimate concerns about anti-Muslim prejudice is blaming the messenger rather than addressing existing discrimination.
Anti-Islamophobia group CCIF has rejected the French government's allegations and pledged to challenge its decision in court. France has launched a crackdown against Muslims after two terrorist attacks in October. One took place in Paris, where a teacher was beheaded after he showed insulting cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad under the excuse of free speech. Another attack took place in Nice, where three people were killed in a knife attack inside a Notre Dame basilica. Both attacks prompted reactions from President Emmanuel Macron's government, all of them targeting Muslims. The government said it would take measures against 76 mosques suspected of what it called separatism. It also threatened to shut down the mosques if necessary. Dozens of Muslims were deported as well. France is home to the largest Muslim population in Europe, and Islam is the second largest religion practiced in the country. Critics say Macron's government is exploiting the recent spate of violence to intensify its controversial anti-Muslim stance. They say such a stance will result in alienation and identity insecurity among Muslims and will fuel radicalization among communities.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. The head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Mr. Masoud Shajere, out of London, and activist and commentator, Mr. Mustafa Chare, out of Paris. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off in Paris itself with Mustafa. Why do you think we're seeing a wave of what appears to be anti-Muslim actions being taken by Paris?
Well, I think this is there's nothing new here. We all know France for being very anti-Muslim. So this is just something repeating itself again, especially when the government is in very bad position, when they face with lots of difficulties. So I think that this is what Macron is about to do here with this this new law and the asking for the dissolution of this organization, the CCIF. I think this is just going to put it into a loophole. So this is what it's about. If we look at it, we know that the term Islamophobia is very much criticized in France. So it is even denied that there is some form of racism against the Muslims. So if Islamophobia does not exist, there's no reason to have an organization that is going to fight and protect the Muslims. So I think this is just something that we have to add, and that is going to conclude the policy line that the governments, the different governments, have been taking in the last year or 4 years.
Okay, Masoud, some estimates say up to 6% of France's population is Muslim, and the birth rate amongst Muslim is much higher than the non-Muslim French population. Do you think that French leaders see this as being problematic? And do you think that some of these measures are being taken basically to try to control these numbers?
I think that's part of it, but I think it goes much beyond that. The reality is that in Europe and in the West, you are seeing rising fascism and nationalism, which is very dangerous. And the fact of the matter is, when politicians like Macron become unpopular and they need to depend more on this fascist vote, this racist, extreme right racist vote, then they start playing the Islamophobia card, as before people used to play the racist card. And this is really the reason If we sort of remember, it wasn't the sort of that beheading and two incident that resulted in sort of this crackdown. That crackdown has started before. Macron starts sort of going for Muslims, saying that Islam is becoming unacceptable, it needs to be modernized, and he's the secularist want to sort of interfere in and define what the right Islam or wrong Islam is. And this is outrageous, but unfortunately, this is happening not just in France, but right across the spaces for Muslims to be able to articulate and defend their legitimate right is being shrinking by the day and by the hours. And what we're seeing in France is an indication of what is happening not just in France, but right across Europe. And it's very frightening.
What about that, Mustafa? I mean, the French God seems to be secularism. Is Paris trying to create basically secular Muslims only and sideline and perhaps control practicing Muslims?
I like saying that if you look at the UK, for example, or the United States, in the UK, you've got the Queen. It is a secular country, but the Queen is at the head of the Church of England. If you look at the United States, when you get elected as president, you've got to swear on the Bible. So it means that these countries, they have a different conception of what a secular society is. You've got freedom of religion. The French secularism we experience today is secularism has become the norm. So you have to be secular to be accepted. So of course, the French society and the government is trying to shape the Muslims. It's like we want Muslim without them being Muslims. So this is, and we all understand it when we understand the French society. It is a society in which you have assimilation and not integration. Assimilation means that you have to change yourself, get rid of what makes you different to be accepted. So which means that they want to have Muslims who are no longer Muslims. So this is what they want, you know, Muslims who are ready to change their names and so on. But this is part of the French DNA. It is something that we cannot change. Now, it's not a matter of color, being white, black, or North African, or from North African backgrounds. It is part of the French culture. It's part of the French DNA, which means that you will find black people thinking the same. You will find North Africans, Arabs, thinking the same. And this is why the fight is so difficult, because it's not just about the host community that we have to fight, but we also have to fight about against those who are. Who seem to be on our own side.
Okay.
So it's very complicated.
And very interesting. Masoud, what about that, what Mustafa has just taught, that basically, although France says is an open society, democratic society, free society, but basically he didn't say that they don't really want religion, but specifically they don't want Islam. They don't want practicing Muslims. There seems to be such a major paradox and contradiction in what the French say they believe in and what the reality is being practiced on the ground there, especially by the government itself. Your take.
Absolutely. I mean, this is really outrageous. They're using the skews of secularism and a special position of France to be Islamophobic, not religiophobic. You know, they don't go for the Jewish community, they don't go for the Christians and the nuns. You know, they specifically go for Muslims and actually become Islamophobic. This is what racism is all about. They talk about freedom of the speech being absolute, and, you know, so Muslims have to put up with abuses of cartoons and so forth and so on, but they are not free to use freedom of speech to speak out to the power in the form of, you know, these organizations like the CIF and others. So they need to be shut off because they're Muslim. So it's a double standard. This is exactly what Islamophobia is all about. This is what exactly what the rise of fascism is. And it has always manifested itself and justified itself. And I have to say that, you know, in Britain and United States, we've got the same thing. It's just nothing to do with swearing on the Bible or Queen being the head of the church. The reality is that Islamophobia is right. You know, only recently we had someone appointed for head of the equality unit in Britain who is Islamophobic. And, you know, it actually says she doesn't believe in Islamophobia existing. So really what we are seeing right across Europe and the West, there is an attempt to social engineer a new form of Islam and to promote that. And let us just remember the incidents, two incidents we were talking about in France, which was one of them was beheading. There were another two incidents, one shooting a priest, which happened to be a dispute, a family dispute, and the other one was extreme right, going out with a knife, shouting Allahu Akbar and attacking people, which was then shot by the police. But that did not start a vengeance against extreme right. The reality is that any incident is being used to undermine Muslims, and it's popular. You know, Macron is becoming more popular by being Islamophobic, and that is the cause of all this.
What about that, Mustafa? I mean, do you see the whole situation basically being ironic when France says that Islam is in crisis, when that country itself seems to be in total meltdown, with much of the French population saying they're not satisfied with their government, pointing out the economic inequity, government's poor performance with the pandemic and growing police violence. But then Macron is talking about Islam being in crisis. How do you see it?
For this one, I'm going to say this one. 61 billion euros, this is the French debt. So just saying this, we know who is in crisis. How can you say a religion that is growing and growing all the time, decades after decades, how can you call this religion in crisis? You've got more people coming to Islam today than ever before. So I think Macron is in crisis because of the coronavirus and because the deficit of France. So this is, and of course, the easy target now is to try to find some kind of federation with the whole nation. And we know that Islamophobia is very, very strong in France. If you look at the French identity, it was forged in a way after the battle won by Charles Martel in 700 something. So this is when you have the first French identity. It is when this war leader defeated some Muslims. Okay, so this is why this idea is very, and this image is very often taken by the FN, the National Front in France. So I think it is more France that is in crisis. Why? In terms of population, there is this thing they call le grand remplacement, the big or the great replacement, with new generation of Muslims who were born in France from the third generation, okay, and practicing Islam. And also because of businesses, you've got lots of Muslim businesses, you've got a kind of middle class of Muslims that is maybe disturbing the establishment.
Masoud, how much does France's colonial past and colonial-like present play a role in the way that Paris views Muslims?
A lot. I mean, it is the psychological mindset of colonialists and the way that they behave and treat others and see others as sort of human to themselves. You know, these colonial powers, be it sort of France, Britain, or Austria, they actually see the Muslim citizens not as equal citizens, but they see them as a colonial subject. And they want to treat them as such. You know, they want to order them around. They want to give them no rights. And when they speak out, how dare they speak out? You know, in the name of freedom of the speech, the power is used to abuse the powerless, i.e. the Muslims. But then Muslims are not even allowed to sort of articulate their issues in the form that we are seeing now, or what is happening in Austria. The disease of Islamophobia and the use of it by the bankrupt politicians, it's something which is very dangerous and is being effectively used. In the same way that the race card was being used and the otherization of a small group of people, which colonialism was using as the main and sort of tool. Mm-hmm. So all these are at play, and we need to expose it. And I don't think France could resolve this problem internally. We need to take it internationally, because this is an international disease which is affecting all of us in Europe and in the West.
Okay, well, I'm going to get to that in a couple of minutes, but why would the French government, in your opinion, Mustafa, shut down this leading organization which fights Islamophobia, unless Paris actually wants to control those fighting against racism and against Muslims?
I think it is because of denial. It is clear now that France is a racist country. It is not just, I'm not talking here about the population, I mean here the institutions. So instead of facing the problem and trying to sort it out, sometimes in France we prefer to deny things. So this is why I come back on what I said first, that many people are contesting the term Islamophobia, saying that it does not exist. Look at the term racism or race. Race was taken from the French dictionary some few years ago. So how can you fight against something that does not exist? So we are very strong when it comes in France. When I say we, because I live in France and I'm also a French citizen, we are very strong when it comes to deny things. And this is the reason why, this is the very reason why you have this law against the denial of the Holocaust. Because they know that in France we tend to deny things. The only thing that we cannot deny in France is the Holocaust. Why? Because France was guilty. Even if the General de Gaulle, the French, who was the French president in the 60s, even if, because he was an excellent negotiator, even if he was able to pass France as a country that had won the war, we all know that France lost the war and France took part in the genocide of the Jews.
Well, Massoud, now many Muslims are saying, and you were talking about this a bit ago, saying the future for Muslims in France and in the West in general, they see it as more repression and a greater crackdown and attack on their Islamic identity. What do you think? I want to look at France, and then I want to look at other countries such as the UK or the US in general. Do you see that it's a level of deterioration in dealing with relations with Muslims in these countries or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Islamophobia is this century's racism and is very right. And, you know, bigots and the extreme right and those who want to sort of have a cultural war and sort of puritanism of white skin and so forth are involved in Islamophobia because this is acceptable form of racism. It leads to other forms of racism eventually. And the fact of the matter is that now in most of the world, people don't deny that there is Islamophobia, but what they do as classical racism, they blame the victims of you know, they blame the Muslims. You know, Macron likes him, likes of him. You know, they don't, I don't think they deny, But what they say is actually is extremism within the Muslims, which is the cause of Islamophobia, and so we should shut down all the Islamic sort of centers and so forth as a means of combating Islamophobia. And I think that's the real key thing. The fact of the matter is that there is an attempt to social engineer a new form of Islam, an Islam which is subservient to oppression and will not challenge, will not speak the truth to the power, and become subservient colonial subject. And that's what they want to do to us Muslims right across the West.
Well, what's key, Mustafa? What is key in your perspective to changing what seems to be coming more and more a growing reality, and this attack on Muslims, and more Muslims actually, in certain cases, losing their Islamic identity to fit in, to get a job, to progress or succeed in these various countries? What's key to changing this around?
Well, I think that the most important for the Muslims living in France is to get financial power, because it's very sad to speak like this, but it seems that the society we live in only understand the language of money. When you have money, they will keep quiet. So once the Muslim community in France will have the purchasing power, will have an economic power, I think things are going to be easier for us. Our votes are going to count. So this is what we have to do. Keep on working hard in terms of education, getting ourselves educated at university. Even university, you know, I work at university, but I know I'm in good university. I'm lucky for that, but I know in some universities they do not like people like me, like myself. Why? Because my background is Muslim, because I did a PhD involving the Muslim community and all these things. So okay, we are targeted.
All right, let me give 30 seconds to Masoud. Same question, your take, Masoud. What's key?
Well, I you know, the money and the power, it's useless if there is no self-confidence and confidence in ourselves and in our deen and our belief. We need to be a confident community to withhold this sort of abuses. This is, you know, one side of the abuse. Then on the other side, you've got all these home office or house Muslims who are, you know, trying to implement the same thing on behalf of their masters. We need to be confident to withstand these attacks on us and move forward. And I'm convinced that if we do that, and if we stand up for justice for all of us, Muslim and non-Muslim in our society, we could actually come together and create a better